Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the World of Ink Network, founded in 2011 by Virginia Grenier and Marcia Cook. Their vision was to start a radio show that helped writers reach their dreams. The World of Ink has a wonderful group of hosts who are dedicated to delivering shows to entertain and inspire listeners. The World of Ink Network shares resources that introduce tips, products, and services to help strengthen, support, and challenge those who love writing and the written word. Their hope is to bring not only authors, illustrators, and publishers together, but screenwriters, directors, and producers. New to the network will be a variety of special shows, bringing not only entertaining shows, but informative discussions on timely subjects. To learn more about us, go to www.worldofinknetwork.com or visit us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for your support and enjoy the show.
Hi, everybody. It's Marcia Casper Cook. We have a great show today, and I just wanted to explain a little bit about last show I had. Something did happen with when we were on the air where they allowed me only 15 minutes, and then we restarted the show. So in case you heard it, it was just out of all these 9 years, it's never happened to me before. But we retaped it about 20 minutes later. So if it sounds a little disjointed, that's really what happened. And it was with Lee Michaels, and she's been on before many times, and so thank God she understood. And it's never happened, so I don't know. I'm looking at right at my screen now, and it's 2 hours, so we should be fine. But if you heard the one, I didn't want to, because we talked so much about so many different subjects afterwards, I didn't want to take it off because it was a really good show. So it's on, but it doesn't have the usual beginning. But it has an hour. So, okay, that was from last week. Okay, so then let's see. We have some new shows coming up, and we're going to be having more children's shows, and I'll be talking with a lot of new children's authors and people that have never been on our show before. We used to do a lot of children's shows, but we haven't. And so I am going to do this because I think the messages out there need to be good ones for kids. And so I think that if any of you are listening and you are children's authors, contact me because we're going to start up again with doing more children's shows because I think it's a time now where kids need to hear good positive messages. And so we'll be continuing the shows all the way through the year, and it should be fun because we have a lot of new surprises, different people hosting, and so it should be good. And today my guest host is Elizabeth Black. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing
it's
very
been a
well.
Few weeks.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
Well.
I don't know. The weeks go
yeah,
so
I
fast.
Know. It's been quite a while.
I know. We have a great show. Dana Cameron's on, and I know you want to introduce her. And do you want to say a little bit about yourself so, you know, we can – then we'll go on and then
yeah, sure.
introduce
okay.
Dana. Okay.
I'm Elizabeth Black, and I write erotic fiction, dark fiction, and horror. And some of my books are erotic romance, the novel No Restraint. And in horror, it would be my short story Infection appears in Teeming Terrors. Trailer Trash Zombies appears in Midnight Movie Creature Feature 2, and Fog Over Mons appears in Wicked Tales, The Journey for the New England Horror Writers. And I have a new book coming out in the winter and probably early next year called Happily Ever After, a collection of erotic fairy tales. So that's pretty much where I stand right now as far as the publishing world goes.
And that's good. You got a lot coming, and you'll be doing some of the shows with
yeah.
me, so as always.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that's always fun. So we'll have just, I never know, you know, we add new shows all the time. So, okay, you want to introduce
mm-hmm.
Dana? I'm so
sure.
happy to have her on.
Okay. Yeah, me too. Okay, Dana Cameron's background in archaeology inspired her novels and short stories. Her Emma Fielding mystery novels have been made into TV movies on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries. Her crime fiction has won multiple Agatha, Anthony, and McCavity Awards, and she was shortlisted for the Edgar Award. So there's a pretty basic
quite
intro.
A bit.
I don't want to go
quite
into too
bit.
Much because I think you'll be talking about it over the hour.
Yeah, we'll talk about everything. Mm-hmm. Hi, Dana.
Hey, how are you doing, Marcia?
We're happy to have you. Very happy. And you
yes,
have some exciting
happy.
News. There's always some exciting. It looks like you have exciting news all the time. So it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's life's been pretty busy. Every year I say, okay, I'm gonna dial back a little bit and take it a little bit easier, and every year things get a little bit more crazier. So I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing. Certainly when you're a writer, the busier you are, the better you are, because we don't know how to do it any other way. We just keep
going, all of us. Yeah, it's like it, unless you're working, you're really not quite happy with the world. So,
right, if we're not writing. Well, Elizabeth, do you want to talk about, I know what you wanted to talk about, so why don't you, you know, I know that archaeology was one of the big things you wanted to talk about with Dana, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, first I wanted to know, what was your specialty in archaeology?
My specialty was historical archaeology, which means I studied cultures that used written records. And so what I ended up focusing on the most, for the most part, was the colonial period in New England, so from early contact mm-hmm. with Native Americans through about 1760. And I spent a lot of time researching about people you don't see too often in the historical record. You don't see a lot about women or children or people who are enslaved or servants or people who were, you know, disenfranchised in some other way. And so I spent a lot of time looking at that. And it was also an excuse to study the Romans when I went to school in London for a year. So that was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you find the information about the people that are lesser known? How do you go about getting that?
Yeah, well, part of it is you start with, you know, the local history, and then you start to see if you can find documents like wills or diaries that are associated with a particular household. And sometimes you have to be clever about the way you pick through things and find references that people would just discount as being sort of day-to-day things and try to put them within the larger social context. For example, if someone talks about meeting Mrs. So-and-so for a tea party, you think, oh, great, tea party, that's nice. But then you start to think about the kind of porcelain they would have used or the kind of tea, which would have been very expensive and imported, the manners that would have gone into it, and the fact that they would have been creating their culture. They would have been negotiating marriages and other kinds of connections, and that was hugely important, especially to merchants in the Northeast. So it's you could say, oh gosh, tea party doesn't mean anything much until you start to learn more about the social context of it. And sometimes you look out and get letters, which are wonderful, because then you hear in the person's own words what they were thinking and what they wanted out of life.
Wow.
Yes, yeah, so I guess you would also look at birth records and death records if they had anything like that at the time.
Oh, yeah, birth records, death records,
oh, yeah.
Marriage
mm-hmm.
records. Sometimes if there's a gravestone, you could get information there, like what kind of carving did they have on it? Was there a particular Bible verse? You could find out what their religious inclinations were. And so it's like looking at all the tiny little things. Archaeologists are always portrayed as digging up fabulous treasures. And
right.
sometimes it happens, and usually what we're looking at is the trash. It's stuff that people discarded 300 or 400 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and that's the stuff that it's all the private parts of their lives. I mean, what they had for dinner, what they ate it on. It's looking at all the little things that put together a larger story.
Yeah, and the things that people look up, I suppose.
Yeah.
We all have to look it up, but you mm-hmm. actually are a part of this, which is so interesting for a writer.
It's been in my blood. I wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid, but then I had the impression that you had to get into fights and join, get into bar fights and run off to war, like the whole, Hemingway sort of meme. And I said, well, I don't want to do that. I don't like adventures. And so I'll be an archaeologist because that involves study and travel and research and, you know, languages and history and things that I loved. And it turned out to be a really good fit. So it wasn't until after I had been in the field for a number of years that an unpleasant incident on the coast of Maine drove me to write fiction about it as well.
Wow.
And we were working on a project, the same, it was a bit 1607 and 1608, so it's the same time as Jamestown. But no one knew about it. In fact, we didn't know about it. We'd been in the field for many years. And we started to look into the fact that there was a short-lived colony in Maine, and we found evidence for it. But what started me writing fiction was when I was on the site with my boss, and we were surveying the site, making a map of it. And a man came onto the site with a metal detector. Now, you can't use a metal detector on public property in Maine, state property, without a permit. And, of course, we had all the permits, and we were the only ones who were supposed to be there. But when he started digging, my boss spoke out and told him he couldn't do, and the guy pulled a gun on us.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't
that changes
me.
That changes things a little bit. Wow.
Yeah, it did. It really did. And, you know, I have friends who work in really dangerous parts of the world, and this was not something I'd ever expected. Again, remember, I was trying to avoid adventure. but
right, yeah.
Well, he was cussing us out and threatening to shoot us and everything, and I'm thinking, well, if I run, is he going to shoot? If I don't run, is he going to start shooting? So I just decided I'd try to memorize everything I could about him, and then, you know, if something happened, I was going to take off into the woods. But fortunately, he eventually left, and we found the park ranger and then spoke to the sheriff, and I had to decide whether
did
I was going to go back
him?
Or not. They did. You know, it's funny because a year later they caught him, and they caught him because he was applying for a permit to use a metal detector on state property. So he was trying to do it again this time without, you know, maybe without the gunplay. So I thought that was really funny. I mean,
well, that's adventure. You got your own adventure. You don't have to worry about Hemingway.
That's adventure in spades.
Yeah. Oof.
You know, I never dug so fast as I did that summer because I wanted a nice hole to hide in if he came back. But I was talking to a friend after that field season and telling her about the things that happened to me and my friends back when I was still in the field. And, you know, the time that my friends got shot at because they were digging too close to someone's still in the Midwest, or the time a cement mixer rolled off the highway in New Jersey onto the site where we had been digging. Mm-hmm. And she says, this doesn't happen to people. And I said, oh, it happens to us a lot, I guess. And she says, it doesn't happen to normal people. You need to write this down, and then, boom. All those.
That's what happened
when I was younger. Like I'd always loved mystery.
Yeah, because you know,
until
I started writing
short stories or novels. Did you start short stories or novels?
No, I started right off with novels. I was used in my academic life to writing things that were 300 pages or so. So a novel seemed like the right idea for me.
You know, I think like when I started writing, I remember when I was looking, you know, we started with romance and everything. They said, oh, you have to find a good profession for a woman. And archaeologist was one that people would want because it's such an interesting field that was always one they suggested. Maybe your character should be an archaeologist or something. So you took it to the next level. You are one. So that's, you know, that's pretty exciting.
It was funny to me when I started writing, I realized that one of the things I wanted to do was talk about archaeology in the very most realistic of ways. I mean, a lot of times when you see archaeology in fiction or, you know, in books or in movies or in television, it's always fantastic, harrowing adventures.
It's a romantic
solid gold goodies. And I really wanted to talk about in exotic locations, and I wanted to talk about what archaeologists really do. And so I was able to do that and mix in some murder and mayhem at the same time.
And know about it, though, really, you know, I mean, you know, it's one thing, you know, because they say write what you know, and, you know, sometimes people don't realize that just putting in some of the things that you know could change your whole story rather than just trying to make up things, you know. When you know something, it just seems to come out when you're writing, and then you can add on to it because you actually know it. But, you know, we're all looking when we're writing for different and, you know, different things to make it exciting, but sometimes some of the things that we know in life can be exciting when we're writing.
Yeah.
If you write it the right way.
Exactly. I think what's funny is that when I was first trying to write this novel and get it published and everything, I went to Middlebury, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and my advisor asked me, the person who was the head teacher who was giving me my critique, said, what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I'm an archaeologist. She goes, oh, I couldn't tell from reading this. I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, and I'm like, oh, wait, how can that be? And he says, well, you don't have a lot of the details in here. And I realized what I was doing is I was leaving off a lot of the little, you know, nitty-gritty because I was an archaeologist. I knew what it was. All my friends were archaeologists, so I didn't need to put it in. And he says, no, you need to have everything. So I went back, and that was actually, I think, one of the most fun things was showing people behind
That was really good criticism, though. That's really good because
it was amazing.
Yeah, because that's early on can help a lot. Because sometimes, you know, I think when writers are, even when they're listening to the show, we never know, if it's too much or too little, And
right.
One of my problems, because what I did, I write screenplays. So when I write screenplays, it's a lot different than writing, because you just go, you're at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. You're there. Mm-hmm. But,
you know,
people really do like it. And that's, I think, really hard to understand how important that is that description, because it's, like getting that advice from
mm-hmm.
someone that's reading your book and they got to the part where they needed to know more means they liked it, but they just want to know more. And so that's good, I think, really good
criticism.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, one thing I like about Past Malice is the detail that you give to the archaeological site and the digging and everything that's involved in it, because I'm not familiar with it. And it's completely different from, what most people think of archaeology, like Indiana Jones and King Solomon's Mine.
Right.
It's like, it's actually more interesting.
Right.
It's more interesting than, finding some great big cache under a rock somewhere. I like the history. That's an interesting part of it.
Well, and you also get to see that there are people who are just like us. It's really it lets you know by looking at historical archaeology, looking at these remains, that there were people who, with a few differences in culture aside, had the same things they needed in their lives as we do today. And I think it makes it a lot more personal. It makes it a lot more interesting. It sort of makes them more human, as opposed to sort of people think of history as these stodgy dates and people in stiff paintings and things like that. And I like the opportunity to see them as individuals when I'm able to.
Right, because I think people think of them in a different way, like that. And because like I mentioned what hit my show with Lee Michaels, she writes a lot of historical. And before I met her, I didn't know that much about historical. She's been on a few times and she's brought other people on with historical. And I think, what amazed me is one time I was listening to one of her tapes and I went like, oh, my God, look at all the sex in here. I'm thinking like, and I was shocked. And I said, what's going on here? I was so surprised that it was so erotic that it was, because she's so historical, but she said that's nothing. It's just part of it, because they're just much just a different time, but they're very much like us, it doesn't matter when that is. And, from then on, I really understood it more because, if you're not really used to reading historical, you just think it's different. Like you just said, you think it's very different than it really is. They're people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, we all got here some way, so we know that they were having sex. And
I know that's right. That's what she said. That's what she said, and that's true, because you just don't think of it that way. But if you look at any of the movies, that they have from historical, there is a lot of sex, because they didn't have they certainly don't have Netflix. They don't have demand where they could be watching TV. So they have, they had to have pastime. And that's true.
Yeah, they had to make their own fun. Yeah, it's
exactly.
But it's at the same time, it's always interesting. And of course, historians didn't like to talk about this traditionally because it was probably their ancestors or something. They didn't want to be airing out the more human parts of their experience. But I think these days we are much more interested in everything about our culture, and so it's not quite as a mystery as it used to be.
So when you write now, you write much more, you're more detailed. That helped you, too, probably, become more detailed when you write.
Oh, sure. Well, some of it was writing more of the archaeological detail.
Right.
And when I write historical, I have a series of short stories I set in 18th century Boston about a tavern keeper named Anna Hoyt who has to solve problems, and because she doesn't have any particular legal standing, the only thing she has on her side is that she outright owns the tavern which she's working in. Her husband is abusive, and there's no police to help her, so she solves things as best she can. And oftentimes that's sort of under the radar and with violence. And so what I have to do when I'm writing a story with Anna or anything historical is to not put too much information in it, just enough to show that life was different. not right. enough to sort of make it be a dissertation or something.
Right.
And that's
right.
the tricky part, because some, you know, that's something I think a lot of people have to unlearn, is not to put in all the research that they do, because it's like a seasoning. You just
right. They put in too much.
The right one in the right place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how much of yourself did you put into your characters? Like, I'm thinking mainly of Emma Fielding. I mean, how much? What are some differences and some similarities between you and the characters?
Well, at the time, I was looking for a tenure track job, and so I decided that Emma would already have one. And I was using a lot of my experiences from the field in terms of dealing with the public or dealing with academic colleagues or dealing with students. Mm-hmm. I put that, a lot of that into it. But also, the way that we're similar, we both want to know what's going on. We both want to find out the mystery. We both want to find all the pieces of the puzzle and put it together and come up with a story about it. I think I probably am a little bit more, I'm a little bit more emotionally brave than she is. I'm willing to admit things about myself faster and learn from it. I think she's more physically brave in that she will, at one point, and I think it was in, A Fugitive Truth, like, okay, she saw who the murderer is, time to take off and hide and find the police, and all of a sudden she starts running toward him. And I'm like, no, this is this part where we're smart and we use our big brains and we use the telephone. And she tackled him. I'm like, my God, woman, what are you doing? So I'm like, okay. So I just went along with it because obviously that was her characterization speaking to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think those are the main differences. I think that I am probably funnier than she is, and I think that she's probably a little bit more uptight than I am, but I'm pretty uptight sometimes. So there's a lot of similarities, but she is not me and I am not her. So.
Right. So I think a lot of people, right, they always think that one. You know, so maybe you want to talk a little bit about how incredibly great it is that Hallmark is making this into a movie. This is like really great news for people.
It's amazing.
We have a lot of people that are screenwriters out there and want their books to movies. So this is so interesting. So tell us what happened.
Well, you know, it really was a fluke because the books are out of print now. They're still available electronically, but they haven't been in print in the bookstores for a while. And I got a note from my agent saying that someone was interested in optioning them. I'm like, okay, that's cool, great, and looked them up, and it was Muse Entertainment, and I found out that they were legitimate, and they were a pretty big deal, and then they said, okay, they worked it out, and you know, I knew from my friend's experience that you can always get an option. It's quite frequently possible to get an option, but whether it's actually made or not, that's the
big
trick.
Exactly.
And so I think we announced the deal in October, November, and then within January, I was told that the show was being greenlit, sight unseen, and then by June, it was on the air. So it happened or incredibly
quickly.
Is it
normally that fast?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, this was it was. I was really not believing the whole thing. For a while. It took it a while to sink in. And so my husband and I went out to visit the set in Victoria a couple of years ago, or 2 years ago. It's been happening very quickly, not all that long ago. And we went out for a visit, and we pulled up to the first location, and I realized that it was the town hall of Machosin in British Columbia, on Victoria. And they had American flags and the main state flag flying. And I'm like, wait a minute. They don't do that in Canada. And I realized that, this was for real. This was my TV show, a movie based on one of my books. And it was really amazing. So it took a lot for it to really sink in that it was actually happening. But it was it's been something else entirely. It's been amazing.
Yeah, it's surreal. I mean, I did some movie work. I did lighting and some makeup on Die Hard with a Vengeance, 12 Monkeys. And it's just so odd to, especially when you watch it later, when you see it on TV. Yes, it's a very strange feeling when you're seeing this.
It's certainly when you're going to see your characters or things that you're thought of are on the screen. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to get a movie made, but it's even hard to get options. The weirdest part about Hollywood is when you have an option, even if the movie doesn't get made, in the minds of people that produce, they go, oh, that's really a good thing, because it's an optioned writer is up above just a writer. And it's so weird mm-hmm. because they didn't have the movie made, nothing. Because you're right, a lot of people have options. But
sure. yeah.
they don't get the movie made. You know,
yeah.
Hallmark, you know, the mystery and the romance, they have more movies than I think most companies. I mean, they really have a lot of movies out there. And they're watched more than once. Like, I myself have watched many of them a lot of different times. And, you know, so I think that they have a good audience.
Mm-hmm.
Their Christmas movies, I mean, they have, you know, I mean, I'm still trying. I really want to write a good Christmas movie. However, I don't celebrate Christmas, and I try to get in that Christmas spirit because I'm crying and whatever, but I can't seem to write that, you know. But I love their Christmas movies, and a lot of people that listen to this show, I know they love them. And so, and the mystery is so exciting because they constantly have new ones coming up, and that's a good thing. So you, I'm
oh,
so
yeah.
happy
no,
for you. I mean,
the thing,
that I
like about it is,
you know,
especially the cozy mysteries, is that they usually take place in these sleepy little Midwestern or New England towns where nothing happens except a murder every other. I mean, it's like they're dropping like flies right and left
yeah.
with all these little murders.
Yeah, we call it Cabot Cove syndrome.
Yeah,
no one wants to be. I'm sorry, Cabot Cove syndrome. It's
yeah.
when no one wants
yeah.
to move to Cabot Cove where, because Jessica Fletcher will probably find you as a dead body at some point. And that was one of the things
yeah.
I was trying to figure out with Emma, too, was if I keep having her, you know, come across bodies when she's digging, no one's going to want to dig with her anymore. And so I had to sort of work around it to find bodies in
yeah.
different places.
But you also have really two great leads. In that, with who's in that? I mean, you know, and that matters a lot.
It does.
You have
yeah, Courtney
really
Lawrence
people
Smith
that are
Emma.
Not just started out. You have some very good leads.
Yes. No, they
Courtney.
They really do work hard. Yeah, Courtney Thorne Smith is doing a great job as Emma. She's super nice. I had a chance to meet her briefly. James Tupper is playing Agent Connor, and he's not a character that I had in the book, but. In the books, Emma is happily married. That was the one thing. She might have everything else going against her, but I wanted her to have a really great relationship. But
yeah.
I guess at Hallmark, you need to have the, are they going to get together? Are they not going to get together? Tension.
Yes,
so
yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we
yeah.
have an attractive FBI agent who is just as interested
in solving. And then they kiss
at
the end, and sometimes they kiss at the end, and that's it. That's the only thing you see at the end is that when they're kissing, you don't see a lot of that, but that's their style, and people understand it. You know, and
yeah,
they wait for
yeah.
that. You know, they do.
Yeah.
They wait for the ending like that. They go, oh, good, when are they going to kiss already? And then they do. So it's probably easier that's their format, you know. I mean, because I think when people write books, you know, they all think, you know, being an agent, I know they all think that their books can be movies, but not everyone can. And Hallmark makes that decision of what can be made. And they do a good job.
Yep, they really do. It's what I have liked seeing was that the viewers, the fans of the show, will say, "Oh my God, there have been two movies so far. When are they going to finally kiss?" And I'm like, "Well, if any luck, they won't kiss for a while because I would like them to make more movies."
Yeah,
but it, you know, it is amazing though how many viewers. I mean, it really is. You know, they have their own audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just people
really
that
do.
Pick up. They have a strong. Strong audience. I mean, they do.
Yes. Yeah.
And they usually, you know, I would almost say when they make a movie, they're pretty sure of what they've got going. It's not like, well, will it succeed? They all, you know, you already know that they've got people going to be watching this, you know, because they've
yeah,
got the audience.
They do. They have the audience. They know what they know the audience, and. It's just keeping up because they always want more and more, you know, more mysteries, more Christmas, and they are always on the ball, creating the content for them.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, and they have a lot. I mean, you know, and then they play them all over and over again, and people keep watching them. So I think that they know what they're doing. I mean, they do. You know, it's not like other networks. It's not even like Netflix, because Netflix, you know. some people, they just don't, you know, you pick up an audience, you lose somebody, because on Netflix, you know, some people say, oh, I don't like this, you know, but on when they turn into Hallmark Station, they know what they're going to get, and they're watching it. They're not going to turn it off. You know, that's just how it is. You know, and certainly when you've got a good cast, you know, that really helps.
And they're, they're consistent. It's like, you know, every Sunday there is a cozy mystery, and you don't want to miss it. And it's like, if you missed it, then the next week they show it at 7 o'clock so you can catch the 9 o'clock new one.
Right,
and,
exactly.
They just finished a whole bunch of Murder, She Baked. I was watching a bunch of those.
Yeah, you know, and you know, so I think that, you know, I think that's why I always tell people that, you know, when you're writing a book, you know, I tell people that are screenwriters, actually, because I am a screenwriter, and it's very difficult to get that screenplay to people because they always don't like something in the screenplay, or they go, this isn't right, or they don't want this character. But this way, if they like the concept of the book, they do their own thing. And so I tell people if they have a screenplay and they can and they can write a book, not everybody can, if they could, it's better than putting it in your drawer as a screenplay, because then somebody might like the book and then make it into a screenplay. And that's really the way it goes now. You know, and it's so exciting for people to, you know, there's one thing, you know, I probably should say this. I forgot to say this. I usually do. It's about me. But, you know, I because we talk about books a lot and screenplays, I had myself, there was a contest called Book Academy Awards, and I went like, oh, what does that mean? You know, so I looked it up, and it seemed okay, and they don't charge for the contest, so I went, okay, fine, I'll just, you know, because I'm not big on contests, although I think a lot of people like contests, but I have not really signed myself up too much. So I put myself in it, and I'm thinking, well, sounds like a good idea. So then I completely forgot about it because I sign up for, like, everything. You know, I sign up for this webinar, that webinar, and this, you know, site. So then all of a sudden I get this message that, you know, I think you should be tuning in tonight. We're going to announce some of the winners, the finalists for the contest. So I'm like, okay, fine. So I just – it was after dinner, and I just finished the dishes. I just sit down. I'm like, oh, fine, I'll just – put it on. And so they made the most incredible deal about this that I've ever seen on Facebook. There were hundreds of people in there. And so I'm thinking, oh, fine, I'll just keep listening, you know. And then so they got to the romance category, and they called my name as a finalist, and my husband's sitting there. I'm going like, oh, my God, I'm a finalist in this, you know. And he's like looking at me. And then I proceeded to stay on. I mean, they picked 10 and everything, and I thought, this is a really good idea, though, because they made a lot of buzz, and the fact is that books really are what they use in a lot of the movies. So I think this might be one of the first times they did this, and I think this is a great idea for people, because I think books don't, a lot of times people don't realize, you know, what happens to the screenplays. They don't go anywhere, but books do. So I think that they started something pretty good, and they had such buzz. I don't know. You know, it was really funny. Then I went back in my emails, and I saw my email, and it says, like, oh, you're one of the – I didn't even know I was one. You know, I guess I skipped that email. But if I – it was such an interesting thing. And, see, that's the thing. Once people make a buzz of something, it becomes bigger than it is. So it's so exciting for people. And I think that people don't get that excited. Like, you know, like when you have a movie made, I don't think people understand how hard that is. That's why, you know, that you got this out as a movie is so exciting, because it doesn't just happen. It really doesn't. It's hard to get a movie made.
Yeah, it's been kind of mind-boggling. And it's like you said, I just assumed that I was one of those people who would never have a movie made of my work. And, you know, I'm like, kind of the long shot. But then when it happens, it's really fascinating. It's a really fascinating process.
It is exciting. That's why, you know, and I think that, you know, so I always give, you know, people, when I've done 9 years of shows, and I keep saying, just keep writing and keep doing these things, because I don't think people understand how long this takes, how hard this is, and what needs to be. You just can't stop. If you really are a writer, just write.
Right.
You know,
correct.
Don't stop. you know, and you never know what could happen. So, like, you now you're going to have a movie made, and you probably, like you said, never thought about this.
I really never had. I mean, I caught myself saying, well, I can't go. I had to reschedule a haircut or something, and they said, oh, what's up? Is something wrong? I'm like, no, I'm going out to visit the movie set. And it sounded so pretentious that I kind of had to catch myself. I'm like, but okay, but, the, no,
yeah, but
this
it's
is
the
real thing.
Yeah.
It's the truth, yeah. I guess it's less pretentious if it's the truth. Yeah. But it was
yeah,
one of those things, like, you never expect to hear yourself saying that.
No, you don't.
So.
You know, and then all of a sudden, like, when certainly, like, in this thing for me, I see people that have been on my shows, people that have been on my websites, and all of a sudden they're making such a buzz. Everybody's that I haven't seen in years are going, oh, congratulations. I'm thinking, like, I'm just the finalist, but I'm thinking, like, oh, my God, I guess it means more than I thought this did, you know, because the book is, you know, it's been out since January, but they're like, oh, really? You know, and that's the truth. See, so you never know. You have to stay in the game.
Yeah, that's it. There's a lot to be said for longevity and stick-to-itiveness and, yeah. And
it's hard to do that.
Sure. Oh, gosh, yes.
You know,
yeah.
So how do you market? How do you, because it's really, that's a hard thing to do. How do you market? What do you do for yourself?
Well, it depends. I mean, I try to maintain a presence on the internet, like Facebook and Twitter. And I used to do a blog, but it's become so hard just to think of something, you know, hey, here's a day in my life, because my life is pretty, pretty dull, you know, apart from these one or two incidents. But also I used to blog to a blogging group, La Femme Fatale, but these days a lot of it has to do with going to conventions and networking with folks there and getting on panels when possible. And
that's how I met you in the first place. I met you at NECON.
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
came up and asked
yeah,
you to, if you'd like to do a show. The networking,
yeah,
I understand fully what that's about.
Yeah, no, I love MeCon. It's again, it's another experience. I didn't think that the horror and speculative fiction world would be something I played a role in, because I thought, you know, traditional mysteries. But after I got done with the sixth Emma novel, I was trying to figure out what to do next. And Charlene Harris and Tony Kellner, who did a terrific collection of anthologies based on werewolves, vampires, zombies. And they said, would you want to write us a werewolf story? I'm like, oh, yeah, gosh, yes, thanks. And then I was so excited. And then I ran to my office library to see what books I had on werewolves, and I realized I don't have any reference books on werewolves. I realized that my life as an academic had been short in that respect. And then I'm like, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? There's not really a canon to go to. There's not, like, with vampires. I could look at movies, but, you know, whose do I use? And I'm like, it took me a good solid 15 minutes to say, wait a minute, this is fiction. I could just make this up.
Right.
And so I came up with Fangborn,
right.
And I decided that they would be, like, secret superheroes who were always on the scene of a crime, not because they were the ones who had committed it, but because they were trying to track down the evildoers who had. I made vampires and werewolves related, part of the same families, and that's sort of where I got the idea that they were always at each other's throats. It's like, well, clearly they're related to each other. And so I had a lot of fun with that, and that led to three novels with Zoe Miller, my archaeologist, who doesn't know that she's a werewolf.
Oh, that's an interesting thing. You know,
how does
you
she
know,
find out she's a werewolf?
I'm sorry?
How does she
right.
find out she's a werewolf?
Well, she starts realizing that when she has these blackout periods and flashes of anger, she starts to realize that there's something going on with her body, and she hasn't been raised among the Fangborn, so and she and her mother are constantly on the move for reasons, and so later on when she runs into a couple of members of the Fangborn family, they explain what's going on, and it was those books were a lot of fun because I got to incorporate a lot of my travels into them. And so Zoe, as an archaeologist, looks at all these artifacts from all over the world trying to find out the origins of the Fangborn and while, you know, fighting off all sorts of evildoers along the way. But
so you were more of a natural than you thought. this could be.
Yeah,
the whole thing about the vampires and the werewolves being at war with each other, I saw that in What We Do in the Shadows, when we had the vampires and the werewolves were locking horns as usual. So one of the vampires picked up a stick and threw it and yelled, "Fetch!" And then one of the werewolves started to go after it and then stopped himself. They were just insulting each other right and left. Very good.
I mean, like, since I've met Elizabeth, she introduced me to all these horror writers, and they were really – we haven't had one of those, like, shows we should, Elizabeth, because it was so interesting, you know, because I think people, they just go, oh, I don't want to read horror. I don't know about horror. But it really isn't what people think sometimes, you know. It's a deep, dark thriller fiction. You know, they're just whatever they are, but it's not what people think because – even in Hollywood years ago, they used to go like, oh, we don't want horror or period pieces, which now changed. You know what I mean? But at that time, they just said, oh, no, we don't want that because they just didn't get it. You know, but since I've met Elizabeth, we have had a lot of shows with people on. And it's so interesting.
Horror's having a resurgence right now, thanks to Stranger Things and Get Out. You know, the two, two really responsible for it. And the books.
And
the
books
are incredible.
Yeah, I'm just been so delighted in that because you're right. I think it's not what people think. In fact, for me, I see a lot of the same roots in horror as I do in noir fiction, where all you have are bad choices. And and it's coming from the same tradition of sensational literature in the 19th century. So that's why what I like to bring to it as well, because that way I get to have sort of the atmosphere that I love from crime fiction and with some of the sometimes supernatural elements and sometimes just unnerving elements. But you're right about the horror writers. They are the nicest, smartest you'll ever meet.
I know.
So,
I know.
And you think, and then you read what they write, and it's like, oh, my God, I was hanging out with these people, and they're wrong. This is just bad. But it's amazing because they're really, really smart.
Yeah, and I didn't know what to expect, and we had several shows like that. And then I loved those shows because I really liked the authors that were on. You know, they were so nice, and it was such a fun show. You know, and even, you know, like I have learned over the 9 years, I have met so many different people that, you know, I think that's why I love doing the shows, because I've met horror writers and I met erotic fiction writers, and I didn't really, you know, because I think people don't give it a chance, you know, and they just go, oh, it's erotic or whatever. And I'm thinking, like, no, erotic could be any love scene or, you know, in the horror films, it could be
everybody
dark.
Everybody thinks, oh, it's erotic. It must be porn.
It's not.
It has a lot
it's
more
not.
Depth than just straight sex. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, and the same, you know, with the horror, it's just like, it's not that way. Because a deep, dark thriller can be also like a horror, you know what I mean? And people read those all the time, and they don't realize it. I think one of the problems is because we have Amazon, who you put them in a category, and then you're dead meat. That's what happens. Because they get in the wrong category.
The whole notion of genre is really problematic. It's been a problem since Samuel Richardson started saying, no, my novels aren't trashy French novels. They're educational, and they're good for you. And that's, way back when, with Clarissa in the 18th century. So, but genre is great for marketing, and sometimes it's equally bad to help you with marketing, I think.
Yes, and I think maybe for people, but for the readers, it's so difficult to get audiences to like your book and find a book that they like because they don't. It's not laid out easy for readers.
Right.
They have
right.
the problem.
Yeah. Well, that's why you love a bookstore where they have staff who know who you are. And,
that would be good.
And know what your tastes
that's
are.
That's really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Do
you have a lot of
librarian.
Bookstores where you are? Do you have bookstores where you live?
We do. We do. I'm just north of Boston, so we have fewer than we used to. But it's one of the great things about living near an academic. Well, I think of it as academic communities, Cambridge and Boston. So it's the landscape has changed. My husband and I used to go out before we started dating. Even we were when we were in high school, we would go book shopping the day after Christmas because we had our gift cards and everything, or gifts that they were back in the day. And we could just spend the whole day crawling from bookstore to bookstore. And these days it's a heck of a lot shorter.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
Yeah.
So, but,
well,
I
live in a small town in Massachusetts, and our one bookstore closed down, sadly. Mm-hmm. It's been here for, you know, decades. And, but, there, you know, the next town over has several bookstores, and the town over from that has, like, Andy's Bookstop is all over the place. And there's a used bookstore that I like to go to where, you know, where I buy a lot of my books. So, you know, the bookstores are, some of them are closing, but then there are others that will open up right around the corner. So there's, you know, there's no shortage of bookstores. Even
well,
though,
I'm in Chicago.
I'm in Chicago
in the suburbs.
The little ones. Yeah.
The suburbs don't have them. They have Barnes and Noble, and you know they have bookstores like that. But then they have smaller bookstores, and unfortunately, there's like a little small bookstore. People have gone in for my children's books, and so they go like, "Well, when was it made? Whatever." They go, "I don't know." The person, whoever it is, asks, and they go, "Oh no, it's not a new book." So I'm thinking, like, that's why I'm doing these shows for children now, because the new book, it's not like the book is 100 years old. You know, the book could be
right.
5 years old. And the people in the books are going, oh, well, it's not a new book. I'm thinking, like, well, so what? Winnie the Pooh? You know, and that's the mentality sometimes of the people in the bookstores. They're not realizing that an old book can still be good.
Oh, yeah.
So
people
like to read back. People like, they find an author that they like, and then they want to read the backlist.
Yeah. And they can't get them sometimes.
They
yeah.
can't get it unless you go to Amazon.
Yeah. And Amazon is having issues now. I think I was listening to a webinar. I didn't finish it because I listen to a lot of webinars, and I think they're having another one with the KDP. It's so confusing out there for authors, no matter, I don't care how many years you're doing this. I think that nobody, there's no exact answer. You just have to go for it. But if you are at a book signing, luckily enough, then people will buy your books. But it's not, they don't even have those as much as they used to have. You know, the staffs at Barnes & Noble, you know, there's not a huge staff anymore, and they don't want to be bothered with book signings, you know. And so I think this is a problem for authors, you know, and I think that the bookstores haven't helped themselves. Because
well,
if you're willing to come for free,
like the book signings. I've noticed that.
If a person's willing to come for free or in a library, why would you say no to them? I mean, what is wrong with, you know what I mean? It doesn't make sense. If you offer, like, your services, you'll come and read children's books to them. They go, oh, well, we don't know. And I'm thinking, like, you're not paying me. I'm happy to do this. But they don't seem to want to do those programs like they did before. So I think, I hope it changes.
I think
you
there's
know.
A lot more emphasis on podcasts, on videos,
yeah,
putting
right.
up a YouTube show or something like that.
Yep. Yeah.
It's definitely more online than it used to be, which, you know, on the one hand, it's you're reaching people who are outside
you never
your immediate area.
Right.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's, you know, you don't get to necessarily hang out and chat with folks, which is a lot of the fun of doing an event.
And I think authors like that. I think every one of us likes to hear what people
say.
It's really important, you know. And
well,
you know what?
We,
people like to meet authors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think any reader does. I'm a reader. I want to meet the folks who've written amazing books. And I think getting to learn something from getting to see other authors too. You're always learning when you're a writer. You never stop learning how to write. And I think that's as big an opportunity for us as it is for a reader.
Yeah. Yeah. I say that a lot, right? Because I think, you know, in the 9 years I've done shows, I take notes and I listen. And I think, you know, you never know everything. So somebody might come on and they say they do this. And I go, oh, that sounds like a good idea, you know. And I think that you have to keep your mind open if you're an author. Then you can stay in the game if you are open. I think you're okay. But if you think that everything you do is perfect and you can't learn, that's a problem.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I really like working with a good editor too, because I think it's like I was talking about before when I wasn't having enough detail in because I figured, well, it was just what I do every day. It just didn't occur to me to put it in. But if you have a good editor, if you have a good critique group, it's you're always going to be better for it. I always am grateful when I'm working with an editor who is willing to negotiate. Like, well, you know, this isn't working for me. could you do this? And I'm like, well, I can't really do that, but how about if I do this other thing? And they go, yeah, great. And and that makes the book better.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. You know, there's a new movie out. It's called The Wife. People should see this movie. It's so it's with Glenn Close. It's really good. And every writer will enjoy this. There's not a definitely enjoy this because it was a really good movie. And it had a lot to do with that, you know, with writing and the characters and who does what in the book. It's very interesting. You know, you're right. You need, because like my editor, sometimes he'll come back and say, like, what about this, this, and this? I go, well, what do you mean, what about this and this? He goes, no. He goes, you may, like you said before, you know it, but it's the person reading the book doesn't know it at all.
Right.
You know, you seem to
exactly.
skip stuff like that. Like, you know, well, like, what time frame is this, or what happened then, or, you know, where were they, and, you know, and stuff that naturally as writers you go, well, what do you mean? You didn't understand this. But then you know that they're right, because you go, right, you know, or they or put a different scene in. So I think you're right about that, because that matters a lot.
So when you're writing a novel or even a short story, when you get so close to it that you can't see what an editor can see, because you need a fresh set of eyes. And even if you're self-publishing, I highly recommend that all authors hire an editor, because they will catch things that you're going to miss because you're too close to the work.
Right. And that's really true, because you miss it.
I really agree with that. It's just, as you said, getting that fresh pair of eyes on it that can tell you when you're doing it right, can tell you when you're doing it wrong. And, you know, remind you that, like, there is actually something there after all the to-ing and fro-ing.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, like, then when you read the book, when, you know, after the editor, you've got it all done, you go, oh, yeah, this works. Or even, like, I know one of my scenes It's Never Too Late, the last book that I wrote for Love. And he said to me, he goes, you know, he goes, maybe you should put this scene in, what about a scene like this? And I went, I don't know. And then he was right, you know. So I know what you're saying, because it's true. Because then when you read it, you go, yeah, this works, you know. Because sometimes we don't see that. Like Elizabeth said, too, you just don't see it, you know. You can't. I mean, that's just, you know, and people, you know, I've heard of people that they go, like, well, I don't want to be changing my words. Well, you know, sometimes your words need to be changed. And sometimes, you know, and that's the thing, you know, like I've had, you know, when I was an agent, people would go like, you know, I want this to be exactly the way it is, and that's it. I go, well, then you can forget it, because that's not true. When you're writing a screenplay, they may like the character, they may not. They may take out a character or add one, like, you know, or add a different profession to them or whatever makes it better. But a lot of times people don't think that's true, and if they're that close, they can't get anywhere. You can't get anywhere by thinking everything you do is perfect. It will never work.
Right.
You have
to
be able to compromise, you know, on certain things. And a lot of people say, oh, I'll lose my voice. That's not true. Your voice gets better if you have it done right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's like, because it's still your point of view. It's still your situation. It's still your characters.
Yes. Right.
And even if the language gets cleaned up, it's only going to be you plus. It's going to be you better, you know.
Yeah, I think that I agree on that. That's a good thing.
You end up with a tighter, better book.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really think so, but you have to really keep your mind open to that. So, Dana, what would you, you know, well, the show's almost over, but what would you say to people, you know, to keep, because I know we have a lot of people that are writing and just some of them want to get better. What would you say to them?
Be always writing. Even when I was working at archaeology, I would steal moments at lunchtime or before I went into work and write. And the other thing besides always always write, always be trying to think of something new to write, is to always find harder and better criticism. Because if you show it to, you know, a friend and they say, oh, it's great, I love it, it doesn't tell you anything. But if you tell someone, if they look at it and say, well, I like it, but I don't understand this. That wasn't clear to me. Or this was working, but this wasn't working, and here's why, what I think would make it better. Someone who's going to be constructive about it is a real gift.
Yeah.
And that was basically how I got I got to the things I did. I went from a writing class to a writing group, and then I went to the writing conference, and that's where I found my first agent, and I got that great criticism that, you know, from my instructor at the beginning of it. And it was, it's always getting someone who's going to be who's going to be fair and constructive and not necessarily brutal or too dismissive, you know, like, oh, it's great, don't worry about it. You know,
I don't give my books out, right? My friends, they read the book when it's done. I don't do that. My editor reads it because I mentioned this. I talk about this all the time. I do not give my book to a lot of people to read because you're going to get different opinions, and this is not a good thing. A review is, that's a whole different story, you know, but when you're giving your book before it's done to other people, right, you're going to say, oh, this is good, and maybe it's really, you know, they don't want to hurt your feelings. You can get your feelings hurt when you're writing because we all know what rejection is. So I think that you have to keep in mind who you're giving it to. That's a really good advice because your friends, it's good. You know, that's not going to help me. It's good. You know,
exactly.
It's when you don't know people that read it that say it's good, you go, oh, this is good, you know, and then you're happy, you know, because they don't know you.
Yeah, it's people that you trust.
Yeah, and when you get a review, if it's good, you know, and if it's not good, you know, you can't let that be the end of your writing. You just have to keep going.
Exactly.
You know, everybody's gotten bad reviews or reviews that you go, what do they mean? And then you just go, oh, I'd forget it, you know. And I think that's the best thing. Just write the best you can.
Yeah.
You know, and write every day is right. That's a good, you know, I'm trying to do this again, write all the time now. Because, you know, I do the shows and I'm always, you know, marketing whatever. But you really need to write all the time because you have, it's certainly if you're writing a book, you can't go back to it a month later. You don't feel the same way you did that last month. You feel different.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't turn out the same.
Yeah. No, it won't turn out the same. Sometimes leaving something and going back to it can be
constructive.
That's true. You get a breather. But at the same time, if you have the opportunity to write and you have something still left in your head that you haven't got down into the paper or into the computer yet, that's really a good idea to do it.
Do you write longhand?
No, I usually work at my computer, but when I'm trying to figure something out, I will play around with it on a yellow pad.
And
scribble and draw little pictures and everything, and usually it's when I'm trying to just figure something out.
Right. I have yellow pads all over the place, right? When I'm in a movie, I'm writing a note. My husband's, like, looking at me because I can't even read what he wrote afterwards because it's dark in the show. But sometimes you get a thought. It has nothing to do with the movie. But you get an idea that if you don't write it down, it's gone forever. It doesn't come back.
Oh, yeah. I have a whole pile of receipts and paper napkins and bits of magazines that I've written things on. And my husband refers to them as dissertation notes because I used to do this when I was working on my dissertation. But now he doesn't dare throw away any little scrap of paper with cryptic writing on it because it might mean something to me.
I know.
And it's amazing.
So weird. I know. It is, you know, it is. That's why it's always good to talk to other authors because nobody actually understands why we do things except another author, you know, because we do these things. You know, I mean, just, Elizabeth, do you ever write longhand? I never asked you that. Do you ever do longhand?
I used to, but I insert so many things throughout the story that I just started keeping everything on the computer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just easier that way. But I have a slush pile. That's just stuff that I've removed from a novel or a short story, and I put it on its own separate document just so that I have it in case I need to use it later. But no, I don't do longhand unless I'm dreaming something and it sounds really good, then I'll write it down so that I don't forget it. And then later I'll look at it and say, what on earth was I thinking?
Yeah, that's the thing. What was I thinking? Even when you have a dream, I woke up a few weeks ago and I told my husband this crazy dream. It just came out. He's looking at me like I'm crazy. But some dreams just stay in your head and you don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows? You know, I mean, and they do sound crazy sometimes, dreams, but, you know, sometimes it's a message or whatever from, I don't know from who, but, okay, Dana, do you want, I have it actually on the homepage of our blog talk, but where can they reach you if they need you? It's already out here, but maybe those that are listening.
Yeah, you can find out more about me at my website, which is danacameron.com. You can find me on Facebook or on Twitter. And I'm usually on an airplane or about to get on an airplane to go someplace else, so keep an eye out for me at whatever convention you're going to next.
Well, that's a good thing, but apparently you like flying. See, this is my problem, is the flying. I have to get myself together. I know. I just have to, you know, because otherwise you don't go that many places. And you travel,
it's
so
tough,
it's good. Yeah. I have to like it. I don't know if that's happening. I keep saying that every time. All right, Elizabeth, where do they find you?
Well, I'm Elizabeth Black on Twitter and Facebook, and I'm ElizabethAblack.blogspot.com on my website. And in early 2019, I'm going to release Happily Ever After, a collection of erotic fairy tales. So all I got to do now is get the book formatted and uploaded, and this will be my third time doing some self-publishing.
Mm-hmm. This is great. And Dana, I hope you'll come back again. It was so interesting talking to you, you know, and I'll post some of your things out there because it's so exciting getting your movie made. So that would be...
Well, thank you both for having me, Marcia.
Okay, and thank
that.
You again. And
thank you. Thank you for coming.
Anybody could reach me at MarciaCasperCook.com or MichiganAvenueMedia.com, and I'm always available for a conversation or two. Okay, everybody have a great night, and take care, everybody.
And thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.